Today on the Fear Me Out podcast, I have the pleasure of interviewing Seth Showalter. I met Seth through Facebook, reading about his harrowing journey to overcoming a religious trauma. As a young man, he was forced to participate in conversion therapy, which is a type of Christian therapy that tries to get people converted from being gay to straight. This is now illegal, but he went through it and he wrote a book called Finally Free, A Surrender to Authenticity. Seth is a licensed clinical social worker and is a supervisor helping therapists become better at what they do. I hope you enjoy this really fascinating interview with Seth. He's very well spoken, very intelligent, and describes a really difficult experience of going through conversion therapy. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today, I have the great pleasure of interviewing Seth Showalter. I actually met Seth through Facebook. I'm always looking for really interesting people to come on my podcast. And as soon as I saw the book that Seth wrote, which is called Finally Free, A Surrender to Authenticity, his book is a personal journey of self-discovery and acceptance. And he went through some major religious trauma, but I'm going to let him describe the nature of all of that. So, Seth, welcome to my show. And if you wouldn't mind, just give us a description of who you are. And we'll start with as early in your life as you're willing to talk about.
Well, first and foremost, I just want to say thank you so much for allowing me to come on your show. My name is Seth Showalter, and I grew up in a really small town in Northwest Missouri, and very indoctrinated into the Christian faith from a very, very young age. In fact, Christianity was the cornerstone of my entire life. And this became problematic for me as I started to recognize and realize that I was struggling with same-sex attraction. And I know that terminology may be triggering to some. However, that is the terminology that I was forced to believe in at that time. This idea of same-sex attraction, that being gay was a sin and that we were same-sex attracted as a result of our sin. And through my entire experience, I went through a lot of things that I detail in my book. And that's all covered in the epilogue. And then throughout my experience, throughout high school, I really struggled with rejection and just not feeling like I fit in. And that really made things difficult for me. And as a result, I began turning to the church more and more and more as my source of rescue and refuge. And in doing that, I began to experience a lot of shame and guilt. And so by the time I graduated from high school, I actually turned to my parents and said, you know what? Instead of pursuing my college degree right out of the gate, I actually did a year internship at a mega church right away. And that was my way of earning God's favor. I believe that if I could earn God's favor by getting involved in a church, that would actually help him make me straight. So my efforts began at a very young age. College, got involved in ministries, did a lot of things like that as a way of earning God's favor when I went on to university. And then by the time I graduated college, I eventually went to my parents and said, you know what? I think I'm gay and I don't want to be. So please help me. Throw me in a room, lock the door, and leave me there until I can walk away straight. And that's really what Christian indoctrination can do, is it can lead us to really believing that there is something deeply, deeply wrong with us, to the point that we make sacrifices that can be deeply damaging to us. So I actually went through a Christian drug and alcohol rehab facility that believed if God had the power to heal the alcoholic, he could heal the homosexual. And I spent 89 days in that program. And my book, Finally Free, A Surrender to Authenticity, recounts actual journal excerpts from that experience with reflections of what I think now, looking back at that experience as a therapist. Because through this entire experience, I learned to accept myself. And I learned that I didn't need to go through all of this deep and dark pain, but rather I needed to learn how to accept myself.
Okay.
And I was able to look back at that experience and then actually analyze what I've been through in a very supportive and helpful way to myself, which I hope is helpful to others.
So, Seth, before high school, when you were in elementary school and junior high school, was your life relatively okay?
Yeah. I mean, I was in a car accident at a really young age. It did complicate things significantly. I was in a coma for 6 days.
Whoa.
When I was 6 years old.
Wow.
So it created some pretty significant challenges, but I grew up in a very supportive family, with a very extended family that was very supportive as well. So, I mean, I wouldn't say that I had a bad upbringing, and I think that's part of what made this so complicated and so difficult.
Sure.
Was because I didn't have something that was super damaging to look at and say, this is what caused all my problems.
Right.
Right.
And what, in elementary school or junior high, did you not feel any attraction to males at all during that period of time? It didn't come till high school?
Yeah, it really didn't come until high school. And I used to run around chasing girls all throughout elementary school.
Okay.
But I don't know if that was me suppressing my feelings or if that was me just not knowing what was going on. I'm really unsure at this point.
Okay. It must have been incredibly frightening when you went through puberty and then started having feelings of sexual attraction toward other young men.
Yes.
How did you handle that?
It got really complicated because the way that this presented was, and it's this, there's an actual excerpt in my book that goes through it, but my first gay experience was actually a very positive thing.
Okay.
I was working overnight at a fireworks camp. And I mean, a fireworks stand, rather. And my job was just to protect the fireworks.
Okay.
And there was a person that I was working with who hit on me that night. But this person was actually very popular, was very successful in sports. And I felt really rejected in my school. So this was like, I'm finally being accepted. I'm finally being looked upon with acceptance. And that really complicated things because I didn't know if this was same-sex attraction. Was I really gay?
Right.
Or was I just experiencing acceptance and this was the way in which I was receiving it?
And how old were you when you had this first experience?
15 or 16.
So you were quite young.
Yeah.
And it sounds like it was pleasurable, so it's not as though it was traumatic in any way.
No, it wasn't. However, and this is recounted in my book, but I actually go on to almost question that entire experience as was that sexual abuse or not?
Oh, okay.
And that was a big question in my mind all throughout my program when I was in conversion therapy. Because I had to have a source. I had to have this is the problem that caused me to be gay. That is what the church was teaching me.
So they blamed it on the person that came on to you at the fireworks stand.
Right. And they even had me go and see a sexual assault therapist.
Really?
At one point when I was in the program. Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like, well, you were there for almost 3 months, right?
Yep.
At this
89
program?
Days.
That's really a long period of time. I'm assuming you started off very earnestly trying to go through the conversion process.
Yes. And that's where my book gets compelling, is because my journal entries are written from the perspective of I really do want to change.
Okay. And that must have been really difficult, that the harder you tried, it doesn't sound like it worked.
No.
And
in fact, it led to further isolation and shame and guilt.
The people that were trying to help you, did they know that their conversion therapy wasn't helping, wasn't working?
They blamed it on me.
Oh, okay. And how was that your failure?
Well, I wasn't trying hard enough. I wasn't surrendering enough. And the facility put it on me that I had a religious spirit.
Wait a second. I want to make sure I'm understanding this. When you say you had a religious spirit, what does that mean?
I was like a Pharisee, and that I was too prideful, and that I was not surrendering fully to God.
Oh, okay. So they really came on. A lot of shame.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming that you internalized that shame because you were earnestly trying to go through the conversion process.
You got it.
Wow. And did you ever get to a place where you started to feel suicidal at all? Or was that not, it didn't go to that extreme?
It didn't get that extreme, especially when I was in the program. However, that's not to say that I haven't felt that way at certain points in my life.
Okay.
In fact, that later ended up to be the catalyst that led me out of the closet.
Oh, okay.
After the program.
So the program didn't, obviously it didn't work. What happened at the end of the program? Did they just say we can't help you, or what was the conclusion?
Oh, well, the conclusion was that I was going to submit to 5 years of celibacy.
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
And you were what? And how old were you at this time that it ended the program?
22.
So a 22-year-old is going to spend 5 years being celibate.
That's what they wanted me to do.
I would say good luck with that.
Right?
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's almost worse than conversion therapy in a way. I'm sorry, I shouldn't joke like that. I'm not trying to make light of your situation.
I mean, it kind of like, I mean, it's a pretty traumatic, like, that's a pretty tall order.
Well, that's for sure. Impossible order.
To give a 22-year-old,
exactly,
which was an impossible task and obviously did not work.
Right, right.
Nor did I carry that out.
Yeah.
But I agreed to that. That's the only way that I was allowed to leave the facility.
Oh, okay.
They wouldn't let me leave unless I committed to some form of celibacy.
Okay. I sort of joke about it because when I work with people that are starting in a new relationship, you know, they ask me, sometimes, well, what's the most likely to succeed approach? And I tell them, well, do you think you could like not have sex for maybe a month or two at the beginning of the relationship? And most people look at me like I just fell off a truck and landed on my head. So the idea that you would last 5 years, I can't even get people to last for a month. So it's just not possible.
Yeah.
You left the program. What happened after that?
Well, I went directly into my master's program in social work. So I had already gotten my undergrad before going into this program, which is partly what complicated everything, because I came in with knowledge from a social work perspective.
Yeah.
So I came in with a clinical perspective,
right?
Which, you know, maybe put me a little bit ahead of where some of the other clients were in understanding what was going on. And also it's evident in kind of my journal writing, because I really kind of come down hard on the facility because I'm like, this is unethical. I don't know what's happening. I don't know what's going on, all of that stuff. And so when I graduated from the program, I went directly into my master's. And I, at that point, was still very much wanting to believe that I could become straight. And I even wrote part of my capstone research project trying to convince that a conversion therapy could work.
Wow. And what year was this what year were you writing this?
This would have been 2013.
Okay. And I know in California conversion therapy is illegal. Is it illegal in the rest of the country or just in California?
That's a really good question. I believe that it is now it is. Okay. I believe it is illegal everywhere.
But it
but
wasn't
that doesn't mean that it's not happening.
Oh,
churches
okay.
are still very much operating in this.
Oh, okay. So it sounds like it wasn't illegal at the time that you went through the
Right.
the program.
I don't think it was.
Okay. And was there anybody in the program that you had conversations with that you sort of shared this idea that maybe this wasn't working so well, or did everybody kind of keep their failure a secret?
Well, so I need to be clear. I went to a Christian drug and alcohol rehab facility.
Okay.
So everyone else in the program was there for substance use.
Oh, okay. Okay. So you're the only person?
I was the only one that was there for conversion therapy and substance use treatment.
And were the people there shaming of you also because of the sexual aspect of things?
Some were, some weren't.
Okay.
So it was a mixed bag. And that's included in the book.
Okay.
I write specifically about what some of the people I was in the program thought and how they responded and how it really made me feel.
Okay.
And how I processed that because I had to live it day in
sure.
and day out with these individuals while pursuing this treatment.
And was your family part of the treatment? Did they come? I mean, a lot of drug and alcohol treatment involves family therapy and all kinds of stuff.
Yes, they did. So my parents actually flew out from the Midwest and came to California
okay.
and met with me there. And we did family therapy for 2 or 3 days.
Okay. And Seth, you have siblings?
I have one.
A brother or sister?
I have one older brother. He is 7 years older than me. And it happens that he is also gay.
Wow. Did he go through the same shaming and no?
No. So Brent, my brother, which I shouldn't have said his name, but I don't care at this point. My brother Brent, he essentially did what he needed to do. In order for him to survive, he separated himself from the family because he was so nervous about excommunication and how my parents would act or respond.
Oh, okay.
That he just separated himself.
At a younger age?
As soon as he graduated college.
College, okay. And are you and he connected to each other in life now?
Yes, we're actually very, very close, and he just got married.
Oh, good. That's so nice. And what about your parents through all of this? At some point, they must have realized that this program wasn't working.
Yeah, so my parents handled it in interesting ways. They really struggled with the entire ordeal. It shook the foundation of their faith in a large degree, but they eventually came to terms with it over time.
So do you have a relationship with your parents at this point?
I do.
Yeah, and they accept who you are?
They do as best as they possibly can.
Okay. It sounds like your brother sort of paved the way for that in a certain way, I guess, being 7 years older.
Yes, he did. However, we came out very, like, around the same time.
Oh,
so
okay.
we kind of handled it and together in a way. He came out and then they kind of dealt with it. And I kind of watched the aftermath of how my parents handled accepting his homosexuality.
Right.
And it was based upon seeing their reactions
And
how they processed.
Yes.
That kind of led me into wanting to pursue conversion therapy in the first place.
Oh,
because I knew how much this was hurting them.
Oh, okay. So again, it sounds like you guys really loved each other and that this was a really difficult issue for the family to come to terms with. And so do you guys talk about it now? I mean, they must know you've written a book and that the book is probably fairly critical of, you know, the approach that was taken to try to help you. Do you guys talk about this stuff or with like with some families, you just avoid it because it's going to cause trouble?
Well, they're mentioned all throughout it.
Oh, okay.
So they were just very concerned that I was going to mention names of individuals and that this could hurt the family. And so I have gone through the book and changed everyone's names. Oh. So all names have been changed in the book.
Okay.
Including the facility. The facility name is different. The staff are different.
Okay.
The friends are different. Everybody is different in the book.
Okay.
And I try very, very hard in my reflections as the therapist to do damage control.
Oh, okay.
If you will.
Yes. Sure.
Where I show grace and mercy and understanding looking back at the experience, because now I kind of see it in a different way than I did at that point. So everything negative that is said, I provide some context as to what is really going on and why they feel the way that they do, which has helped pave the road in them accepting this book for what it is.
Now, I'm curious about something. Did you lose your connection to God or faith as a result of the conflict between who you are and the philosophy of the religion that you were brought up in?
That's a good question. So, yes and no. It's a hard question to answer. It's mentioned in the epilogue of my book.
Okay.
And this is kind of what I want to say. I have lost faith in the foundation of religion, specifically organized religion.
Okay.
However, I haven't lost faith in the idea of a creator. So I've deconstructed parts of my faith, but not all of it.
Okay. So do you feel like you were able to retain a strong connection to God, but just in a different context?
Correct.
Okay.
But it's a very different context.
Yeah, well, I would imagine it would have to be. I mean, I talk to a lot of people. One of the main things that I think is overlooked in the field of psychotherapy is our spiritual body needing to be fed in some way or another. And most people believe that the best way to do that or the only way to do that is through organized religion. And I try my best to help people understand that if that works for you, that's okay. But what about the idea that organized religion doesn't work for a lot of people? Do you have to throw the baby out with the bathwater, or can you retain a really strong connection with whatever your version of God is and let go of the religious dogma and all of that kind of stuff?
Right. Which is what I have done as best as I can. So like I hold the Bible now with a loose hand. I don't hold it as infallible, for example. I don't hold it as the inherent word of God, but as a book of wisdom that's been handed down over time and been influenced by people, as we know historically over time.
Right.
So, you know, I've been able to kind of look at different aspects of the faith and deconstruct them independently and then slowly rebuild what I think now.
Oh, okay.
But like I don't go to church.
Okay.
I don't engage in that type of stuff. But to say that I don't have faith in a creator or that I don't have a connection to God, I think would just not be true.
Okay.
Because I definitely do.
Very good. So I don't think we finished talking about what happened when you were in your master's program that helped you get to a place of kind of acceptance of who you are. Would you mind talking a bit more about that?
Yeah. Well, so part of the acceptance portion of my book was I had to come to terms with my own self. Do you know what I'm saying? Because I think so often in the healing journey, we worry so much about what other people think,
right,
and not what we think.
Right.
And specifically in regards to sexuality, or specifically what we are attracted to as individuals, it really comes down to what we are comfortable with ourselves.
Okay.
And in college, I spent, you know, because I was still on that celibacy track, right? Like, I had left this program. Like, I had agreed to 5 years of celibacy. I was in and out of that, like trying, but then not trying, trying and then not trying, using research and then not using research. Like, I was all over the board. And so I tried lots of different things to kind of resolve my own questions around sexuality. I met with spiritual leaders. I met with secular leaders. I talked to mentors. I talked to advisors. I talked to other gay individuals. I got involved in the gay community.
Okay.
And really got involved in kind of seeing what life was like. And through that experience, I learned that it doesn't matter what other people think. What matters is what I think and my personal relationship with God.
Right.
And the rest of it doesn't really, the rest of it doesn't really matter.
How long did it take to get to that spot?
About 10 years.
Well, that's a long time. That's a big, long struggle.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not here to say that I am completely there yet. I you know what? I'm human.
Right.
I know my book is finally free, A Surrender to Authenticity, because that is the path that I believe that all of us need to go down.
Right.
But do I still have moments where I struggle? Heck yes, I do.
And what do those, do you mind?
But I'm on a journey.
Do you mind talking about what those moments look like at this point in your life?
Yeah. Yeah. So sometimes I look at my life and I'm like, is this really all that there is? Because I have reached a point where, you know, I have learned to accept myself for who I am, but I'm not in a relationship. I've never been in a relationship. I've never taken those steps because I've been so scared.
And
now, yeah, at age 34, I feel like I'm so selfish. I don't want anyone in my personal space. So let's just be real.
Wait a second.
You know, I think
you're 34 years old and you're already habituated to living by yourself. I'm sorry to laugh.
I'm pretty independent. I don't want anyone in my personal space. So I'm like, you know what? I don't want a relationship, or do I not? I don't know. But do I feel okay in my own skin? Yes.
Okay.
For the most part. However, there are some times when I walk into a church building, or if I go back home and I hang out with certain family members, or if I'm around certain people from my hometown, am I triggered and I start to experience a lot of those feelings that I felt when I was a young child? Absolutely. Okay. And I have to, at that point, look at those situations and combat them with my own knowledge and my own life experience and say, you know what? This doesn't matter. What matters is loving and accepting myself for who I am, regardless of what anyone else thinks. And it's an up and down battle.
Right.
And it's something that I'm going to continue to battle. And I accept that for what it is, and I'm okay with it. And I think we each need to be at that point where we don't judge ourselves too harshly, but that we challenge ourselves with moving forward to accept ourselves for who we are as people.
Right. Did you lose friends as a result of not being able to go through the conversion process?
Yes, I did.
People that were dear to you?
Yes.
And do they know how much their lack of acceptance has hurt you, or is that something that you just had to kind of let go of?
I had to let go of.
So there's no changing intense dogma?
No.
Okay.
And in fact, it's mentioned in the epilogue of my book, but, you know, one of the things that Actually, I kind of want to read a portion of this.
Yes, please do.
So this is out of the epilogue of my book, and it applies directly to what we're talking about. I just literally opened my book and turned right to it.
Okay,
so very cool. I feel like I should just read this.
Please. I would love that.
But it says, however, there still remains a deep part of me wanting some kind of admission of wrongdoing, or at least some indication of regret from those who emotionally controlled and manipulated me, failed me in their own promises, then rejected me. Most individuals who know me and are still involved in the church, as well as the staff at NH, have remained firm in their stance against me. I am just another failed case in their eyes, another poor, unfortunate soul destined for hell. Most evangelicals look at me with pity, then turn their backs. Others choose to ignore the fact that I am gay and pretend to love the sinner, hate the sin. This is a ridiculously patronizing cliche, by the way. Speaking of, just let that line go, Christianity. If being gay is just another sin, you shouldn't have so many difficulties with transgender issues either. Obviously, deep down, people know gender and issues of sexuality involve more than just choosing to live in sin. By coming out, members of the LGBTQIA+ community aren't just having a willy-nilly sexual heyday. And so in looking at this, you know, I wanted some admission of wrongdoing from those individuals who rejected me.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to get it. And not I likely. Have to be okay with that.
So not a single person has been able to let go of their prejudice and let you know that they love you and can accept you for who you are?
Well, I don't want to say no one. There have been people in my family who have.
Oh, okay.
So people on the family side have. There has been maybe one other person or maybe two people on the Christian side who have. But most people that were deeply involved in the decision-making that led me to this path have not.
Okay. Whew. Can I tell you how deeply sorry I am about that, even though we don't know each other well? I just feel that is just so unjust and so painful to imagine.
So yeah, it was hard, and I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, I just want to extend some compassion toward you because you are very eloquent and you seem like an extremely kind, capable person. And it's just such a shame that people would not choose to have you in their life for some, if you want my real feelings, some stupid, random way of looking at things.
Right. And it's just sad. I mean, it's 2023.
Yeah, no kidding.
You know, the fact that this prejudice still exists in our society is honestly despicable.
Yeah.
In my opinion.
Well, I'm really lucky because I live in Santa Barbara. It's a very liberal sort of minded community. And so the gay men that I encounter in my practice especially don't have to deal with a lot of what it is that you describe because it doesn't really exist here. Except in the minority, but it sounds like where you grew up, it's the way the majority.
Yes, it is.
So that makes it difficult. And what about where you live now? Which part of the country are you in now?
I'm in Missouri.
And again, I'm a little naive because when you're brought up in California, California is a very, very egocentric state and all the other states are just an afterthought. So I don't really...
Fair enough.
I don't really know what it's like.
This is not an accepting state.
No. Okay. And what about
but I am in a liberal city.
Oh, okay.
So
okay.
I want to throw that out there. Okay. I live in a liberal city in a very, very conservative state.
Oh, okay. Because now you are a licensed therapist, right? I mean, that's part of what came out of your education.
Correct.
Do you have a private practice or how do you live your professional life at this point?
I work for a group practice as a clinical supervisor and therapist.
Okay.
I also help run a lot of our social media and podcasting stuff. Okay. So I'm kind of like a brand ambassador in a way.
Okay.
But I am a full-time therapist, and I absolutely love it.
And do you have a specialization, or is it a general practice?
It's a pretty general practice. I mean, the practice itself does cater a lot to ADHD.
Oh, okay.
And depression and anxiety as generally. I tend to be pretty general and eclectic in my approach, like okay. general depression, anxiety, grief. I use an ACT approach, so acceptance and commitment therapy. I take a lot of concepts from that,
okay.
but then tying in things from CBT, DBT, different types of therapeutic modalities
okay.
To really enhance the therapeutic experience for the individual.
So you don't necessarily specialize in religious trauma per se?
Well, I'm trying to.
Okay.
I have several clients who struggle with religious trauma, and I'm stepping yeah. into that realm.
Okay.
But I don't have any specific training in it yet. I will be getting that soon.
I'm not sure what training you would possibly need other than what you've been through in your own experience. What could anybody teach you that you don't already know?
Well, there might be some type of therapeutic approach or technique that they want to throw out.
Okay.
And I'm like, I'm just saying on paper,
right.
I'm not credentialed and certified in religious trauma.
Oh, okay.
But do I specialize in religious trauma and a lot of the clients I see?
Right.
Absolutely, I do.
Well, and I mention it because I've been in practice for about 35 years, and I would say at least 3 or 4 high school age young men have come to see me and have said to me, I'm thinking about killing myself because I'm gay and I don't know what to do. I don't know how to handle the situation. I don't think my family will support me. And for some reason, these young men have been very good athletes. So they've been on sports teams, football team, water polo, whatever. And they don't want their teammates to know, obviously, because they're terrified of how the athletic community is going to respond to them. Plus, they have a lot of trouble because a lot of them are very handsome. And so they get approached by really attractive women all the time. And they don't know what to do because they're not interested, but they have to pretend like they are. So it's a really, really difficult, really sad situation. Now, so far I've been really lucky because I've been able to convince them to hang in there until they get to college, because I believe that even though there's a fair bit of acceptance in my community for being gay, I think college campuses, at least in California, are relatively accepting. And so I try to help these young men understand your tribe. You'll find them as soon as you go to college. So, if you can just hang in there and do the best you can to go through the motions of what you're going through while you're still with your family, or if you're too afraid to come out, then I think that life will get much better for you as time passes. I was able to actually convince one young man to bring his brother, his older brother, in here to do a visit. And his brother, super handsome, really, really, like 6'5", macho dude. And he was really afraid of how his brother was going to, older brother was going to react to him. But the cool thing was, when he told his brother what he was struggling with, his brother started to cry and said, "If anybody messes with you, they're going to mess with me." And that was the best thing that ever happened with this young man, is that his older brother, put his arm around him and told him that, he loves him and that he doesn't care and that, he's safe as long as his brother's around. So luckily so far, so good. But I mean, I can't imagine how awful it would be to go around feeling ashamed of yourself and not being able to even remotely be true to yourself in an environment where you know you're going to be the object of deep prejudice if you tell the truth about who you are. So that's right. Why I was wondering if that was something that you specialize in, because I think it's so, so important.
It is. It is so important, and it is something that I do specialize in.
Okay.
So I should have led with that.
Well, I just want to say thank you for that, because especially in the world that you live in, where things are much more extreme than here, it's so, so necessary, really necessary.
Yes. It is very necessary. And a couple things that I really just want to throw out in hearing that story, right?
Yeah.
One is the importance of self-love.
Yes.
And so that would be one of the building blocks that I start with.
Yes.
But then outside of that, which it sounds like you did, but it's assessing the support system.
Yes.
We know from research that the support system is the number one protective factor against suicidal ideation.
Right.
And given the fact that the LGBTQ population or LGBTQIA plus population
right.
Has a suicide rate that is astronomically higher than the rest of the population,
right.
That support system is absolutely critical.
Right.
And it doesn't matter where that support is coming from.
Okay.
It can be a family member, like a brother or a mother or a sister. But sometimes it can be as helpful as a friend,
right.
Or a teacher.
Right.
You know, support can look in a variety of different ways. And so finding those avenues for that support is absolutely critical, and it makes a huge difference.
Does the community that you live in have the one in Santa Barbara is called Pacific Pride Foundation, and it's an organization designed to help everybody in that sort of world get the support they need. Does your community have that sort of thing, or is it not part of what's offered?
No, we have an LGBTQ center. It's just, I don't know how active it is, to be honest with you. I should probably be more involved, to be quite frank.
Okay.
But I've been a little bit busy with everything, with the practice and with the writing of the book and with everything that's happening, that I haven't really gotten that involved.
Okay.
But I'm going to be doing that in the upcoming months.
Okay.
So I will be getting more involved.
So, Seth, did writing a book help with your healing process?
Well, yes and no. So part of why this book took me 10 years to write was because I couldn't do it. Like, I wanted to do it, but like going back and reading the journal entries was so traumatic and so difficult.
Okay.
That it was very, very complicated.
Wow.
And I really was unable to do it without the help and assistance of an editor who was able to do it with me.
Wow.
And then once I started getting direction, I actually started doing these editing sessions on live on TikTok.
Oh, really?
And that was actually one of the greatest things for me, was because I was able to read my actual journal entries live on TikTok and then write my reflections after the reading, and that helped me process. But as I did that, it was really helpful in processing my own trauma and working through it.
That is
But I really do recommend having a support system with you as you do it.
That's brilliant.
I don't recommend doing it alone.
Who came up with that idea? Did you just think about it, or did somebody tell you that might be useful? Man, that is absolutely brilliant. It's brilliant.
I came up with it.
Good job.
I was trying to do it, and I was like, this is too hard. I can't do this alone. And so I was like, hey, you know what? I could go live on TikTok and just see who shows up in my live. And people would show up and then express interest, and then if they could see when I got too emotional or if things were really difficult, and then they would jump in the chat and be like, Seth, it's okay. Take a deep breath.
Wow.
You're going to be all right. This is all right. This is going to be okay. This is what you should write. And like literally some of what's included in my book actually came from TikTok followers, some suggestions, which is really cool.
Yeah.
And really has helped with marketing the book as well, because they were part of the writing process.
Sure.
Right. So it's kind of everyone's baby in a way.
That is fantastic.
It was a cool experience.
Oh, I love to hear that. So it was a bit of a mixed blessing because of how much trauma got re-stimulated. But at the same time, it sounds like you found a community of people that, really believed in what you were doing and really appreciated what you were bringing to the table. So that helped.
Yes. Yes, it did.
Was it hard to find a publisher, or is it self-published?
Oh, no, I found a publisher very easy.
You did?
I had a lead. So the publisher that I went with is Choir Publishing. They are a religious deconstruction publishing company.
Oh, I know. I had no idea such a thing existed.
I know them personally.
Oh, okay.
I have run multiple podcasts over the years and interviewed both of the co-publishers myself.
Oh, okay.
Multiple times.
Okay.
So I know them. Do you know what I mean?
Yes,
so
absolutely.
When I came out, I was like, listen, Matt and Keith, I've got a book. Can you consider this?
Yeah.
You know? And they're like, you have a what? Yes, we'll read your manuscript.
Yeah.
And now, that wasn't a guarantee that they'd say yes.
No,
of course.
I get that.
But it got me in the door.
Right. Right.
So it helped.
Well, you're still a young man. There is hope for a relationship in the future. I'm hoping for you, even though you may describe yourself as very already settled in.
Selfish. Very settled.
I'm almost twice as old as you, and I appreciate the stubbornness that we all develop over the course of time. But you just seem like such a kind person that a relationship, I think, just adds so much value to life, even though it does mean you got to put up with a fair bit of living, maybe not exactly the way that you would live.
Yeah, we'll see. With time, I've got to take some risks.
Right.
And it's been one step at a time. And these are the big things that I wanted to get out of the gate first.
Sure.
You know, was landing the career, getting the career in line.
Yeah.
Making sure I know what I'm doing and that I'm actually helping people. Then getting my story out there through a book and getting that out. That's now done. So, you know, it's like one thing after another and just getting things in line, and a relationship is going to be something I start looking for.
Sure.
I haven't got to that point yet.
Right. So, what else have I not asked you that is important? Are there any other questions that I'm forgetting to ask you from your perspective?
I don't think so. I think you've hit most of it. I think the most important thing that I like to bring up is that if you are listening to this show and you are struggling, I want you to know that you are acceptable and you are loved exactly for who you are right now. And I really want to emphasize that as much as I possibly can. And no one can make this decision for you, not your friends, not your family, not even your church. This is a personal decision that you have to make, but it is worth every ounce. And when I say a choice you have to make, what I'm speaking to is accepting yourself.
Right.
Not whether or not you are gay, but right. Accepting yourself for who you are. We can live in a position of denial for years.
Right.
And it is not fun. It is depression and anxiety and the whole gamut of mental health problems. It is not worth the struggle. Learning to accept yourself is everything. And I really, really encourage you down that path. And I hope that my book can help serve as a guide to help you, one, recognize and relate to some of the experiences that are mentioned in my book,
right.
But also find a path to finding a different way to live, which is finding love for yourself.
So if you are dealing with somebody who's been brought up in a really conservative community, much like the one that you were brought up in, and they've been told that God hates you if you're gay, that's my interpretation, how do you help somebody realize that that is a fallacy and that they are really worthy of being loved despite what they've been fed by the, by the people that represent their religion?
Well, it's hard. So the first thing that we have to do is we have to validate the experience, number one, because we have to determine where they're getting that belief system, right? Why they believe what they believe, and actually looking at the underpinning behind that. Is it coming from their family? Is it coming from the church? And why are we believing those individuals? Something that I often challenge my clients with is consider the source.
Right.
You know, consider the source of where you're receiving this information.
Right.
Is this information coming from people that truly have your best interest at heart?
Mm-hmm.
Or do they have an ulterior motive?
Right.
And that's a hard reality to come to, especially when your entire faith is wrapped up in it. And so I spend a lot of time looking at the deconstruction process, because what does this really do to the individual is it causes one to feel like they are not good enough and that there is something deeply wrong with them. And so right. We start looking at deconstruction through the lens of self-love and self-acceptance.
Okay.
And challenging the narrative by which we've been passed down from other people.
Do you do any education about the biological underpinnings of a person's sexuality? I mean, there's so much research now about the genetic and the biological chemical sort of, you know, part of what determines our sexual orientation.
There is. There's tons and tons and tons and tons of research.
Yeah.
However, I've really not delved too much into it. What I find is that it often falls on deaf ears when people are really, truly wrapped up in religion. Science kind of gets pushed to the side immediately,
right.
and it isn't even considered.
Oh,
so,
okay.
I mean, we can go there,
yeah.
And I'm more than happy to educate on those issues. However, I find that it isn't always the most convincing arguments.
Okay.
For people that are really wrapped up in the faith.
Sure. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I asked that question because there is a fair amount of anxiety in the people that I see that are, you know, trying to come to terms with their sexuality and their sexual orientation and their gender orientation, all the other, but not a lot of it is as much religiously based here in my community as it is in a place that's much more conservative, like where you are from. So it's been a little bit easier for people to accept science when religion is not, you know, condemning it as strongly in
right.
the community that you live in. So I guess I'm lucky in that, in that regard.
Yeah, 100%. But when religion and science butt heads,
yeah.
or at least they're taught that they butt heads.
Yes.
It's like, it's a lose-lose argument.
Right.
You're fighting against dogma, and we have to start deconstructing that first.
Okay.
Before we can start introducing the science.
Right. Okay. And your colleagues in your counseling center, I'm assuming, are like-minded individuals, much like yourself?
Yes, I work for a very LGBTQIA plus friendly practice.
Oh, okay.
We are very, very accepting and affirming. And a lot of people seek us out specifically for that reason.
Oh, for that reason. Okay. If somebody outside of your community would like information that would be helpful to them, are you guys open to receiving either emails or phone calls or queries? So how best might how best might somebody reach somebody at your counseling center?
So if you live in the state of Missouri,
okay.
I would really encourage you to reach out to us. Our website is www.brave-mo.com. So our practice is called Brave Counseling and Psychiatry. We're located in Columbia, Missouri. However, we serve the entire state of Missouri. So as long as you live in the state of Missouri, we can serve you.
Oh, okay.
We'd be more than happy to do that, both for counseling and psychiatry.
Okay.
We offer both services.
Okay.
And we'd be more than happy to reach out and help. So just give us a call.
And if somebody doesn't live in Missouri, can they are they able to access you for questions, maybe?
Yes,
maybe
they
not.
Are.
I know that the laws, like in California, you're not supposed to do, if you're licensed in California, you're not supposed to do therapy outside the state. I'm assuming right. you're restricted in the same way that we are here.
Yep. It's state licensure, so yeah. It's state laws. I mean, could get licensed in other states and provide those services as well. However, we are pretty busy with the clients that we currently do have and the clients we're currently getting. There is a large need here in the state of Missouri. But if you're outside of the state of Missouri, I would encourage you to reach out to us. We also work in collaboration with another practice called Long Island EMDR in New York. And so we have a collaborative project with them. And so we have a podcast ourselves called Good Enough with the Trauma Therapist. You can access resources there about our practice and Long Island EMDR, as well as resources and tools for mental health and trauma and empowerment to help individuals. So in finding resources and tools and things like that, that's a great place to go for information. In addition to that, our website, brave-mo.com, has an entire blog that we're putting out weekly with tools, resources, step-by-step guides to really help people on their mental health journeys. And that is available to anyone regardless of your state.
Well, thank you for the good work that you're doing. That's really amazing.
Yeah, we're trying.
Yeah. So tell us again the name of the book.
Yes. So my book is entitled Finally Free, A Surrender to Authenticity. It was written by me, Seth Showalter, and it is available on Amazon. And you can learn more about my book at my website, which is sethshowalter.com.
Very good. So anything else before we finish, Seth? I really, really appreciate your time. You're a very eloquent, really well-spoken, from my perspective, young man. I know you may not see yourself as a young man, but you are from my perspective.
Well, I just want to say thank you so much for having me on. I think that your show is making a huge difference in the lives of others, and the very fact that I could come on and share my story and my journey with your audience means the world to me.
Oh, you're so
kind. I want to thank you for that.
You're quite welcome. I hope that everybody enjoys this episode, and please reach out to Seth if you have any questions.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.